I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is journalist and staff writer for The New Yorker, Arielle Levy. She's joined in conversation by writer Carrie Corrigan. And now join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Arielle Levy and Carrie Corrigan.
Arielle Levy has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 2008, and before that she was an editor at New York Magazine. In the pages of The New Yorker, she's covered the lives of fascinating, brave, and unconventional women like transparent showrunner Jill Soloway, South African Olympic gold medalist Castor Semenya, and most recently, photographer Catherine Opie. In 2013, Levy wrote about her miscarriage in a powerful New Yorker personal essay called Thanksgiving in Mongolia. It's impossible to read that essay and her riveting new memoir, which grew out of it, without experiencing some of her anguish, as if you've stepped outside your body and into hers. In reviewing The Rules Do Not Apply, Cheryl Strayed writes, quote, "Unflinching and intimate, wrenching and revelatory, Arielle Levy's powerful memoir about love, loss, and finding one's way shimmers with truth and heart on every page." Appearing in conversation with Arielle this evening is Kelly Corrigan, author of three New York Times best-selling memoirs, The Middle Place, Lift, and most recently, Glitter and Glue. Kelly is also host of KQED's Exactly and co-founder of Notes and Words, an annual benefit concert for UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital. Please join me in welcoming Arielle Levy and Kelly Corrigan to the JCC. Thank you.
Hi. So I can think of no better way to start than to treat these guys to some of your beautiful prose. So will you pick something to read?
Thanks, Kelly. Oh, well.
We didn't plan that. I just caught her off guard.
I'm just going to read it. I'm not going to tell you what it's about. You'll figure it out. In desperation, I go to an Al-Anon meeting. It is on the second floor of a church rectory in a room with green and white tiles on the floor and rectangular fluorescent lights vibrating on the ceiling. There is a table with leaflets and brochures. I take a bookmark that has a list of do's on the front and don'ts on the back. Then I join the dozen or so people sitting in a circle in the kinds of chairs we had in school, the ones with imitation wood trays attached on the right side in lieu of desks. A guy in his 30s reads something procedural from a shabby binder to start the meeting. We have no dues or fees, but we do have expenses. And then says it's time for the qualification. It's confusing. It becomes clear that a qualification is a speech, because now a woman named Mallory, who could be 29 or 52, is telling us about her experience growing up with an alcoholic mother, whom she identifies as her first qualifier. If alcoholics are addicted to drinking, it seems clear to me that these people are addicted to repurposing the word qualify. Mallory says she was raised never to speak about her feelings, never to express the, quote, holy trinity of shame, anger, and fear. I'm in the wrong place. My parents never drank, and I've never stopped verbalizing my feelings. I have nothing in common with these people, and I dislike their awkward pigeon. I look at the clock. I've been here 5 minutes, tops. I wonder if there's a way I could find anyone in the school chair circle attractive. There isn't. I read the list on the back of the bookmark. Don't. Be self-righteous. Try to dominate, nag, scold, or complain. Lose your temper. Try to push anyone but yourself. Keep bringing up the past. Keep checking up on the alcoholic. Wallow in self-pity. Make threats you don't intend to carry out. Be overprotective. Be a doormat. It is, I think, too bad that's not the do list, because then I would score a perfect 10. Mallory has been feeling very triggered this week. Her ex-husband, her second qualifier, has been inconsistent in their negotiations about who should get to spend midwinter vacation with their daughter. And inconsistent, I learn, is one of the four I's. The other three are irrational, isolating, and in denial. And apparently, if an addict is exhibiting these eyes routinely, it means he or she is active, which is to say using, which is to say, as we do in America, drinking. And do you know what denial stands for? Mallory adopts a knowing smirk and pauses for effect. Don't even know I am lying. Several people issue world-weary grunts of acknowledgement. I resist the urge to point out that this kind of no doesn't start with an N. Mallory smiles even more sagely and tells us that, quote, in the rooms, she's learned to keep the focus on myself and not to obsess about her ex-husband's drinking. She has learned to take it one day at a time and to have faith that, quote, wherever I am today is exactly where I need to be because of a program called Al-Anon. My head is about to explode. Why did Mallory not just say Al-Anon? We all know it's a program. We're here right now. Why the phrase in the rooms when the perfectly normal at meetings already exists in English? Why all this mysterious, ridiculous qualifying, and why this reluctance to say drinking when we're all here because of it? Hi, I'm Jason, and I'm grateful to be here, says a man to my left, who still has on his overcoat. He is probably on his lunch break from an office job in the area. Hi, Jason. Jason thanks Mallory for her qualification and tells her that he appreciates her serenity and that he can relate to her experience. The thing about denial, he says, is that it's like sleeping. You don't know you're doing it when you're doing it. There is an extravagantly loud knowing grunt in response, and I am aghast to realize that I am its source. Beer cans crumpled between the sink and the radiator. Why did I ask for an explanation when I saw them there instead of just recognizing what they were? Proof. It seems so preposterous, so funny, really, to think that I was forever worried that Lucy, my spouse, had a brain tumor, Lyme disease, a thyroid problem, a vitamin deficiency. Exactly how deluded would you have to be to live with someone, to sleep with her every night, and convince yourself that she was sober when she was drinking, using, whatever, every single day? A younger woman goes next. She is in her early 20s. Her hair is a streaky, mousy blonde. She wears a skirt and tights and a fuzzy white sweater. There is a trace of something Eastern European in her voice, but it's hard to pin down because she starts to cry almost as soon as she speaks. She moved here with her boyfriend several years ago. At first, it was wonderful, like no home she'd ever known. Now she comes home from work expecting to see him, looking forward to his company, but instead, drunk him is there. And as soon as she sees who it is, she's furious and somehow shocked, even though it's a regular occurrence. Invariably, he denies that he's been drinking. He tells her he feels harassed and monitored, that her accusations make him feel like he might as well drink because he's getting so much grief about it. She worries he will get fired. She misses his attention. She gets her hopes up that things will change, and they do for a while, but then drunk him comes back just when she's starting to forget he exists. I'm not a mean person, she says, wiping her eyes with the back of her hand. But she is mean to her boyfriend when she thinks he's drunk. Sometimes she insults him, calls him pathetic. She worries she's not a loving person. She feels bewildered and angry and guilty, but most of all, she feels insane. When she finishes, several people say, keep coming back, in unison. But that's it. They don't give her advice or respond to what she's just said, even though her face is mottled and pink and her breathing is jagged. I'm grateful to be here, Gavin, an older black man who is wearing a sweater vest, tells the group. I realize that I am grateful to be here, too. I'm grateful not to be yelling at Lucy or to be feeling like a bad person for having just yelled at her. I'm grateful I'm not tormented by whether I'm crazy or whether I'm right. I'm grateful to the possibly Slavic girl for describing something I have experienced, because if this is a pattern, if there is a way that alcoholics from all over the world behave, maybe it wasn't that Lucy didn't love me enough to quit. Maybe all of this was not really her choice, which is to say, not really her fault. Gavin says he's been in the program for almost 20 years. He started coming after his brother drank himself to death. He was demolished by the loss. At the first meeting Gavin attended, someone read something that gave him a flash of solace. Just for today, I will adjust myself and not try to manipulate the situation. He had spent years trying to persuade his family that there was something wrong. But his brother was gone now, and that could not be changed, no matter what Gavin did or said. He opened his mind to the possibility that really it had never mattered. The situation, his brother's drinking, their parents' response, had all always been beyond his control. I think about all the time I spent vigilant, preoccupied, trying to decipher Lucy's relationship with alcohol. It had never occurred to me that the situation was whatever it was, whether I figured it out or not. And it had certainly never crossed my mind that my reaction, my suffering, was mine, something I had come up with, not something I needed to blame on someone else. My job is to interpret and to communicate my interpretation persuasively to other people. The idea that in life, unlike in writing, the drive to analyze and influence might be something worth relinquishing was to me a revelation. Thanks.
So the thing I'm most curious about is to talk about the relationship between narrative and expectation. So that's a perfect passage to start with, because as writers, this is what we do. We make stories and meaning out of the everyday incidents of our lives, especially as memoirists, but even I think novelists or thinly veiled autobiography rings true to me.
Even magazine writers.
Yeah.
And that's the job of writing, is to take some information and make a meaning.
Right. And then I think actually the average Joe is constantly doing the same thing, whether they're aware of it or not.
Right.
I mean, I think everybody to some extent is writing all the time.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, what are some of the earliest stories you told yourself about who you were, about what your life was going to be like?
I wanted to be Pippi Longstocking. That was my role model. I really liked it when my parents would read me stories, and I particularly liked it when they were stories about adventure. I didn't like stories about playing house. I liked stories about going out into the world and collecting experience. And usually, to read a story like that, you had to read a story starring a boy or a man. But Pippi Longstocking was my girl.
Mm-hmm. And so that sort of that, and also your mother led her life in an interesting way and had key things to tell you about who you should be dependent on and in what circumstances. So talk a little bit about your mom and her choices and the man who was much taller than your father.
My mom always impressed upon me, you never want to be dependent on a man. And she didn't mean emotionally. She didn't mean men are not good people. She meant financially. She meant you always want to be able to pay your own bills, because her mother, who's still alive, who's 96, is dependent on the largesse of her children. My mom always said, you don't want to end up like grandma. You've got to find a way to make your way in the world. And I also think my mom was proud of, she really wanted me to be a writer. She really believed in me in that way. And that was, I wonder what it would be like to want to be a writer and not have your mom tell you. Of course that'll happen. Of course you can do that. And in her own life, she didn't have a kind of guiding passion the way I did. She didn't have like a thing she always wanted to do from the time she was a kid. But she did have an unconventional approach to family, I think partly because of who raised her and partly because she was a child of the 60s. So she got it in her head that she could marry my dad, and so they'd be like two short Jewish people and have me, and that she could stay, she could still have this boyfriend, this guy Marcus, who was much taller. He's very tall. And that could just keep going, and that he could come and go from the house, and that, what's the big deal? Why can't you do that? Who says you can't do that?
So she was a person who thought the rules did not apply to her, that there were kind of the idea of monogamy and the typical rules of a marriage were optional.
I think if she were here, she'd be very quick to tell you that people were doing all sorts of, having all sorts of experiments around domesticity and sexuality, some of which I've written about. I mean, you know, this was a time when people thought, let's be lesbian separatists. Let's have women's land and spell women with a Y and not have any man, even boy children, allowed on the land. What? Why is that weird? Why can't we do that? You know? And so
that happened. And
the older I get, the more prone I am to lesbian separatism. Well, I'm sorry, honey. My husband's in the front row. I'm sorry. And his parents from Arkansas are sitting next to him, so I'm really sorry to you guys.
Well, I did a story about a lesbian separatist van gang. It was called, and they all changed their last name to Van Dyke. And that didn't work. No, they did. They did.
It's in the book. It's phenomenal.
And that didn't work out so well. I mean, which is not to say, just because my parents' Fishtunkena approach to having a family and the Van Dyke, just because all that sort of went up in flames doesn't mean I think that we all need to adhere to a traditional marriage and that that's the answer. There's a reason people were trying to blow up those conventions. I don't know what the answer is, but...
Yeah. Are you a person who sort of believes that the best we can do in terms of connecting our reality as we live it to the people that we want to connect to is just sort of agree on a narrative? Like, because what's happening in, say, an Al-Anon meeting or an AA meeting is that people are telling their story the way they want it to be received. They're giving their side of the version, and then they're just getting validated all the way on that version.
Except that what I got out of 12-step world was this idea that you got to stop blaming other people. Whatever has gone wrong in your life, you've elected to be there for that. And you have the power to stay or go. And so fixate, you know, doing that thing in your head where you think, well, she did this and she did this. I mean, what if, you know, that gets you nowhere. And that's what I was trying to talk about in that passage, was that thinking through, well, what exactly happened is productive when you're writing an article or a book. But when you're having a relationship with another human being, it is what it is. So either you want to be there for that or you don't. And that's your choice. That's your power in the situation. So
agreeing on a version is probably counterproductive, actually. Of what happened, because it's backward facing.
What I got from it was just things are the way they are. Take it or leave it. And stop worrying about, stop trying to construct the narrative. Like, just take it as it is. Yeah. Stop trying to think your way around it.
Right.
But I do think, in answer to your question about, is it my opinion that the way to have a successful relationship with another human being is to agree on the rules and the story that you're sort of creating together. Yeah, I do think that.
Yeah. So you went into your life as an adult wanting to break every rule. And I felt like when I was learning about your life that your central narrative was only fools follow the rule.
I didn't think that only fools followed the rules. I just felt very, very greedy for experience. Mm-hmm. Like, I wanted to be Pippi Longstocking on that ship, and I wanted to see all the places I could see and have all the experiences I could have. And to do that, you know, you have to get on the ship. Like, you might have to, like, hide in the – what's it called in the bottom of a ship? That. You might have to hide in that to get where you're going. And so that might involve, like, a bit of cunning. But I didn't think the people who stayed on land were fools or...
Or people who said, well, you can only go through the front door. If you don't have a ticket, don't get on the boat.
I didn't think they were fools. I just thought, I got to do whatever I have to do to have as many experiences as I can. I don't know why I thought that.
Yeah.
But that's what I thought.
And you were making up a lot of new rules for yourself. So you were a girl who wasn't afraid to go with girls.
Right.
You were a girl who wanted to be a writer.
Right.
Which is an incredibly rule-breaking existence because you're not showing up in an office every day, mm-hmm. typically.
That was very important to me.
To not have a traditional job.
To not go to the office. I did, you know, when I was young, I did go to the office every day for a while. And I was like, this is horrible. I can't do this. But... the truth is that the things you just mentioned did not involve much in the way of rebellion for me, because because of the parents who I came from, because of the fact that I lived in New York, you know, in New York and then eventually New York City, and because I went to Wesleyan University and because I worked in journalism, none of the stuff I was doing was that outré. Like my it was no big deal to my parents that I was like, I'm marrying a woman. They were like, good for you. You know, I mean, the only thing they
who
were.
Who pays for the wedding?
Yeah. The only thing they were upset about is my mom was like, you're going to get married. You're going to have a wedding. Like, why do you need to do that? Why are you so square? Truly, that was her only objection.
You're listening to journalist and staff writer for The New Yorker, Ariel Levy, whose new memoir is The Rules Do Not Apply. She's joined in conversation by writer Carrie Corrigan on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And then there were thoughts that you had about monogamy and yeah. like whether you couldn't kind of be in a post-monogamy relationship, like whether it could be more special or finer or original or your own version of a relationship.
Yeah, I thought
and that you
that.
Could experiment with your body a little bit but still love the person you loved.
And that's an example of something where I think, had I been with a partner who was fine with that and who was – we were telling the same story, I think that would be fine. I know people of relationships like that, and it's fine. But it wasn't fine at all with my partner. And that's why I think it was really atrocious, actually, that I cheated on her. Because that was not the story she was telling. She wanted a traditional marriage, you know?
Yeah, that her expectation.
Yeah, I mean, in fairness to both of us, we both articulated what we wanted. And just sort of chose not to hear it when the other person was like, that's not what I just said.
Right. So tell us a little bit about Lucy.
I think kind of all you need to know about what a generous person she is that when I wrote this book, which is a lot about her and about our relationship, and I said, okay.
And her addiction.
And her addiction. And I said, read it. And if there's anything you can't live with, I'll take it out. And she said, I'm not going to censor you. It's your story. You do what you have to do. That's who she is. She's a really generous person. And as much as I couldn't continue to be married to her, I think it was an incredible blessing that I got to be with that person for 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about her addiction.
You know, sort of like what was going on in that chapter I was reading. Addiction addicts, it's sort of banal. Like, they're all the same. I mean, it's always the same story. It's mm-hmm. it's really excruciating. I'm sure anyone here who's ever loved an addict, not just a spouse, but a parent, a child, a friend, it's excruciating because they can't control their addiction. They don't want to be addicts. They just are. You can't control it, but you get hurt by it all the time. And there's no one to appeal to. There's no there. So it's harsh.
Yeah. So you guys decided that you wanted to become parents.
Yeah. I thought she had conquered her addiction. I thought it sort of seemed like we had finished our sinning. I was done cheating. She was done drinking. We were moving forward into a new chapter.
And your affair came out and yeah. you talked about it. And yeah.
The reason my affair came out was because Lucy said to me, I think something's going on. And what I could not do was tell her that reality was other than what she perceived it to be. Like, I could cheat on her, but I couldn't deprive her of her faith in her own perceptions of reality.
Oh.
Because that to me, I mean, that's so important to me to be able to, that's what I do all the time is try to perceive what's going on so I can write about it. It just seemed, that to me was inviolable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you guys decided that you were going to put away childish things, so to speak.
Yeah.
And that you were going to make a family.
Yeah. Yeah.
Talk about that a little bit, those decisions and
Well, I had been really conflicted about it for a really long time because I first of all, it took me until I was sort of in my middle, edging towards late 30s, to feel like I was a good enough person to deserve to be a mother. Up until then, I really thought, I don't know. I just may not be good enough. That was one thing. And then another thing was that, like I've been saying, I mean, I really wanted to be an adventurer since I was little. And I just thought to choose motherhood was to relinquish the status as the protagonist in your own life. And you would see the path calcify in front of you. And there, you know, your choices are chosen. And until my late 30s, that seemed, I just couldn't do it.
It's interesting when you talk about fertility and how cocky we can be as young women who want the world and everything in it, about waiting and thinking that, you know, listen, I had my period every month for 20 years. Like, I am due this baby. I am owed this.
Yeah.
And there is a sense of entitlement with the way that we as women pay in advance for the for a functioning uterus.
Absolutely. Those monthly down payments.
Exactly.
Think, you know, exactly. I've literally been bloodletting.
For this moment.
For what? For at that point, a long time, you know, 20 years.
And then you start to see it fall apart for people. You started to see some of your friends go through infertility treatments and waiting much longer than they ever wanted to and really coming up against the rules of the body.
And those rules will always apply. There's there's always going to be mortality, and there's always going to be a limit to your youth.
And you had this incredible moment where you said that you were both a person who was bounding toward adventure, but you were also looking to crawl in the pouch of some benevolent kangaroo. I mean, you're not going to read a better sentence than that this year, so... And that's who Lucy was to you.
Yeah,
and so
absolutely.
You had found this place where you felt safe enough. And then in the moment that you were pregnant or that you were inseminated, I loved it that you said, I wasn't sure until that moment.
When I got up from the table after I was inseminated, the reproductive endocrinologist, because that's how it works. if your spouse is a woman, that's how you do that. When I got up from the table, I was like, oh my God, I can't wait to be a mother. I hope this works. I didn't feel ambivalent at all. I was like, here we go.
Yeah.
And unlike many of my friends, at that point I was 37, unlike many of my friends who went through years of stuff, I got pregnant quickly. I got pregnant the second time I tried. And I felt like it felt like making it onto a plane right before they closed the gate. Like,
yeah,
I got this,
yeah.
You know?
And then you had an opportunity to go cover a story in Mongolia.
Yeah. And it was, and I thought, great. First of all, I thought great because I asked the doctor and he was like, yeah, it's fine. You can fly until the third trimester. You're 5 months pregnant. You can go wherever. And second of all, I thought, oh, great, because I thought, once this baby comes out, there's no more Mongolia. There's no more adventures of this kind for a while. This is the last adventure like this for a while. I'm going on a new adventure. I'm going to be somebody's mom.
And tell us the story.
And I was somebody's mom, but only for 10 minutes, because the second night I was in Mongolia, I went into labor, and I had my son in my hotel room by myself. And, you know, that was it. That was the most transcendent and the most painful experience of my life, is that for 10 minutes I had a kid. And then I didn't. And the pain of that, for a long time, like when I got back from Mongolia, I was so sad. I genuinely could barely breathe. Like, I just would wake up every day and be like, this is a crime against nature. This is not acceptable. Like, I cannot
agree to these terms. And 2 weeks after I got back from Mongolia, Lucy had a total alcoholic meltdown. It became clear she had never stopped drinking, and she went to rehab. And I thought, that's it. I can't do this anymore. I can't do this. I can't do two recoveries at once. And then I just thought, I am screwed. Like, I am finished, you know? Like, I felt like all these things that I had thought, you know, well, I'm a different kind of woman. I'm an adventurer. I'm a writer. I'm married to a woman. I can do whatever. I don't have to be constrained by all these societal norms, you know. Suddenly I was like, well, that's interesting. I'm 38, childless, and alone. And I suddenly felt like I was like a cautionary tale. And I felt like I was having an identity crisis because a switch had flipped in my heart. And I was a mother. I had experienced maternal love. And a switch had flipped in my body. I was lactating. I was making food for a baby who wasn't there. So I felt in the deepest part of myself like a mother. But that was invisible to the world because I had no child.
I think that one of the things that pains me the most on your behalf was that there wasn't a witness, that you were alone in that moment, and that there's really only one other person in the whole world who saw your son.
Yeah. When I got to the clinic in Mongolia, it started before then. When I was in the hotel for a little bit, I was just checking out my kid and just being like, look at you. Like, look at you. And then eventually I was like, I think I probably need to do something. Because, you know, it was talk about blood letting for your whole life. I mean, this was. So I had the phone number of a doctor on my pad, and I called him and I said, this happened. And he said, you know, your baby's not going to live. And I said, well, he's alive now. And he said, well, I'm going to send an ambulance. And I said, because I was in shock, well, if he's definitely not going to live, I'll take a cab. That's what I said. What can I tell you? That's what I said. And he said, no, that's not a good idea. So then I went to the hospital. Then the ambulance came, and I went to the hospital. And my doctor was this man, John, who was from South Africa, where I had reported this story about Caster Semenya. So I got to the clinic. And somehow we started talking about Cape Town, blah, blah, like, I remember thinking to myself, I'll deal with you later. Like, I got to focus.
Did you come in holding your baby?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
And was he already gone?
Yeah. Yeah. No, he was and gone before the ambulance
up.
Came.
You could stand up? I mean, you weren't just.
It was messy.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't pretty, but yeah, I could stand up. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh. So it's just, you were just alone through the entire life of your child.
Yeah.
It was just you alone.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, just me and my guy. Yeah.
What would you have named him?
I don't know. We were in negotiations over that.
Yeah. So you got to the hospital and you meet this man, John.
Yeah.
And then you have a witness. Then you have one person.
Well, then there's someone who saw what, when I got back, was like so true to me. This, to me, the reality was what he saw. Here is a mother with her baby who has died. To the rest of the world, I was just a lady who didn't have children and never did.
And then you had a picture.
And then I took a picture when I was there. When I called to get the ambulance, I took a picture of the baby because I was like, I need proof. Even for myself, I was like, I don't know if I'm going to believe this happened. Like, you know.
Right. And there is that. I mean, everyone can relate to that incredible feeling. Like, sometimes if I wake up in Boston and then I end up in San Francisco at the end of the day, I kind of like can't believe I was in Boston
yes.
that morning. Like, so compounding your situation was that you were in this far, far away place, and then you're back in New York City.
And I think for that reason, I mean, I couldn't leave for a while. Like, I was there. I didn't go home for, like, 5 days. I couldn't leave. And it was hard. I mean, the hotel room was, like, there was, it looked like there had been a massacre in this hotel room. But I couldn't go because I knew at some level, once I leave, this is real.
Right. And then you got back to New York. And how did you resolve in your mind kind of what had happened and what it was? Or did it take writing a whole book about it to really make meaning of it?
For a long time, I mean, my experience of grief was that at first it was something I lived in, like a tunnel in which I existed. And then eventually it became something that lives in me, mm-hmm. you know? Like, so there's a little hole in my heart for that baby, and I don't aspire for it ever to scab over. Mm-hmm. Like, I want that hole till the day I die. Because it's appropriate. I'm his mom. I should always have a hole for that kid, and I always will. And earlier today, I was reading somewhere, and afterwards this woman in her 70s raised her hand, and she was like, she's like, I have 2 children who lived. I have 5 babies who died. I miss every single one of them. It's never stopped. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that sounds right to me. But what changed is that initially, that what I was telling you about, how initially it was, I was like, this is a crime against nature. Eventually I was like, no, this is nature. This is nature herself. This is nature.
And didn't Dr. John say something like nature is wasteful?
No. My baby's father, his mom had written him this letter, and she said to him, nature is wasteful. Like, she had shown him when he was a little boy all the acorns and things on the floor, and she was like, nature starts many more projects than she can finish.
It's an incredible. I mean, that must have been a turning point for you in terms of your understanding about it and what context to put that experience in.
That helped me get over the initial guilt, the initial overwhelming sense of guilt that I had done this, that I had killed my child, and that had I not gone to Mongolia, he would have made it. Now, eventually, you have enough doctors tell you, it's just not true, girl. Like, this was what was going to happen. Placental abruption, which is what I had, doesn't matter. It was not going to work out. Eventually, I accepted that. Mm-hmm. Initially, I did not. But I also think that's part of grief, you know, is self-recrimination often. And especially with miscarriage, I think it's a huge part of the experience is self-recrimination.
Right, that somehow you're not right.
Yeah.
And that...
You did this.
Right.
You failed your
child. Yeah, I remember my friend saying that a doctor told her she had an incompetent cervix.
Yeah, that's a thing.
And she wanted to punch him across the face, but she also, like, cried herself to sleep that night. Like, I'm incompetent. My body is not competent.
That is the medical term. Thank God that's not what I have. But that is one of the terms, is an incompetent cervix. You know, another one like that is a blighted ovum. I mean, there's a lot of really very cruel terms for these things, you know. And one of the first... Speaking of cruel, one of the first emails John, who became my pen pal, sent me was he emailed me after I was home because my medical insurance, you know, he needed to give me a chart report to send to the insurance people. And then I said, is it normal that I'm lactating? Like, is this a problem? And he said, the milk letdown reflex after a miscarriage is one of nature's less kind tricks, which I was like, well put, my friend. Like, it is. The oxytocin mm-hmm. that sets on contractions also signals the body, like, you got to start making some food. So once you have a miscarriage, that's a mean thing. So, and then we started writing to each other, which at that time was like the only solace I had.
Well, he made it real. Right?
And then, weirdly, we also, like, had a lot to say to each other. Like, he had lost a lot. His mother had died when he was 3. His brother had died when John was 18 and the brother was 21. The country that he grew up in didn't exist, you know, was gone. Rhodesia,
for many good reasons, but that's another matter. Like, and he would tell me these stories about like his childhood in Africa, and it was transporting. So A, he was there and made my experience real, but then B, he was like, it was stories again, right?
Yeah.
It was like he was Pippi Longstockings too in his stories, and that transported me out of my like horrible reality that I didn't like being in.
Mm-hmm.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features journalist and staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, Arya Levy, whose new memoir is The Rules Do Not Apply. She's joined in conversation by writer Carrie Corrigan. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
I thought you did such a beautiful job talking about grief.
Thank you. I've
had my own share, and I thought that you saying that you worried that your grief was disproportionate was such a common thing. I think everybody who grieves feels like, am I like overdoing this? Like, does everybody right. cry this much? You know, is this, or am I a weakling?
Am I melodramatic?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
Especially, and I've heard this now because since the article Thanksgiving in Mongolia came out, I hear from a lot of women who've lost babies, children, you know, who've had stillbirths, who've had all sorts of stuff around this. And they all have that feeling of like, am I nuts that I have this much pain that I feel like I've lost my child, but it's just a miscarriage, you know? Like,
mm-hmm.
miscarriage doesn't quite make you feel, that's not quite it. Like, Euripides wrote, what greater grief can mortals have than to see their children dead? Like, that's more like it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what do you want now? I mean,
well,
you wanted so much. You were like this voracious, ambitious girl who wanted to get into the secret treehouse, which
yeah.
is what David Remnick said when she started at The New Yorker, was welcome to the secret treehouse. What do you want now? And what do you think is gettable? What's reasonable to want?
Well, what I got out of this whole experience, out of losing everything, and what I'm grateful for is I was liberated from my illusion of control. You know, I was liberated from thinking that if I was just strategic and dogged enough, I could get it all together. And
you almost did. I mean, you were this close.
I was this close. But you don't, but nature's the boss. And that, in a way, as much as it hurts, as much as I have a hole and I wish I had a 4-year-old, knowing that I'm not the boss, that there is something greater than me, and it's nature. That's my God. That is the liberation. Like, I'm off the clock. I'm not running things. I'm not imagining that I'm in charge anymore. And I am so relieved.
Yeah, it's totally exhausting. Before you cross over from that moment, which I think most people have to get to that moment in their lives, it is so exhausting thinking that you're going to come up with it day after day after day, and you're going to put the pieces in place, and then one is going to add up with one to make two, and two is going to add up with two to make four, and it's, you know, it's like an input-output machine.
Yeah.
And of course,
no, and it got blasted away, you know? It just got blasted away for me.
And but beyond that, it's not, for you, it's not actually a terribly negative place. It's actually like, okay, I'm resetting, and now what do I want?
Yeah, and it took a while. Like, you know, it took a long time to get through this tunnel of grief and to sort of like swim out the other side. And to start, and to get from this is a crime against nature to this is nature herself. And one of the things that got me there was like, you know, so I felt like a total failure as a wife and mother. I clung to my identity as a writer. That was like, I was like, what do I still have? Who am I still? Well, mm-hmm. I'm still a writer, so I'm going to hang on to that. I still have these friendships with people that have been, you know, 20, 30, 40 years in the making. That's some love that I guess I'm good at. I'm going to cling to those. And then eventually, John and I fell in love. And that opened up, like, who saw that? Like, that's weird. And so then now there's this whole other part of my life where I'm, like, in South Africa, and he taught me how to ride horses, and I can, like, drive a Land Rover on the wrong side of the road, stick shift, like, all this stuff that I'm like, really? You know, I didn't see any of that coming. Like, that was not the plan.
Yeah.
And that's great, and that's a great reality, and I love this life.
I mean, I have seen a picture of John, and he's real cute, so... Let's start there. He's not like a hard guy to fall for, but how
he has a certain charm.
Yeah, and he's a great writer, and he's a great storyteller.
Yeah.
But how is there any quantifying how significant it is that he was there in that moment to your?
I'll never know.
Yeah,
I'll never know what it would mean to meet him any other way.
Yeah. Have you tried to imagine it?
Yeah. And I'm like, well, where else would you meet that
him.
Guy?
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't have. And vice versa. I mean, it's fun. That's what's funny to me is I'm like, to me, he's like very exotic. Like, he can like build a house with his hands and like ride a horse and be a doctor like in the woods. Not the woods. What do you call it? The bush, you know, and like.
We call it the woods, but sure.
It's different there. There's not tree. It's different. Anyway. Get this. He's like, a Jewish girl from New York. It's so exotic.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay. If you think so, it's not.
There's tons of us.
Yeah. We're a dime a dozen.
Yeah.
He doesn't know.
Yeah.
But I ended the book before that. I ended the book before I fell in love with him because I didn't want to write a story that wasn't true. It'd be technically accurate to say we fell in love, but it'd be entirely misleading, back to this idea of narratives, because that would suggest then Prince Charming came and I was saved. No. It didn't save me from the grief of losing my child. It didn't save me from the grief of my first marriage ending. It didn't make it so that I could have another child. I can't. It didn't solve anything. I still had to deal with I still had to swim my way out of my own tunnel of grief. It's just that once I got out the other end, there was this whole other
It just started
thing.
A new story.
It started a new story.
But it's not actually the appropriate ending to this story.
It's not the ending to this story. The ending to this story was getting out the tunnel of grief and finding a way to have some hope again.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting how much pressure there is to put things into the familiar narrative forms that we like, that make us feel good, that are soothing. And so it's all the more impressive that you resisted the urge of the sort of narrative compulsion to end it with, and now we're in love and we're getting married,
yeah.
Yay!
I did not want to do that.
Yeah.
For a number of reasons. First of all, I don't think it would be accurate. I think it would be misleading. And as a journalist, it's very important to me to be accurate. I mean, I've spent 20 years trying to be specific and precise and accurate. As a feminist, I would not like that message. And it wouldn't, again, it just wouldn't be true. So we want the same story. That's why even though when we met, he worked in Mongolia, he lived in South Africa, I lived in New York. He's 17 years older than I am. He had just finished raising 2 children, you know, just about. I was desperate then, like as desperate as you can be to have a baby. Despite all of that, I mean, that sounds like an uphill battle, which is that was the other thing. That was the other reason I didn't want to end on like, and then everything was fine. Because actually, that was its own hard thing. But the reason it works, the reason we're together is because we want the same life. We have the same story.
Where will you live?
We want to live in more than one place.
Uh-huh.
We'll live in New York and we'll live in South Africa.
So you're still breaking the rules. You're still like reinventing.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I suppose so. Like, we're it's like I always had this fantasy when I was a kid. My favorite thing was like, and this is part of why I went to Mongolia, because when I went, a third of the population was nomadic. And I always, to me, the most comforting idea in the world was like a nomad's tent. And you've got, and it's your house, but it moves. It's like your home and you're safe. It's a kangaroo pouch and it moves, you know? And that's how I feel. That's what John wants that to. That's how we want things to be.
Yeah.
We want to move and, you know.
Is there a way for you to be a mom?
Yeah, I could adopt, you know, and maybe I will. I mean, it's no small project giving everything you have emotionally, financially, and physically to the effort to have a biological child. It took a lot out of me. So it's, I'm exhausted from that. Like, I'm not ready to enter a new process, which is complicated and expensive and often full of disappointment. You have to steel yourself for that. And I don't know if I'll ever get there, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. I mean, it's not like, that's the other thing. It's not like, oh, and then there's a happy ending. It's like, there's another story, but like, I don't have children. I don't get that, you know, and I may never get that. Everybody doesn't get everything, which I know is old news.
But not to you, it wasn't.
Not to me, it wasn't.
I think to everybody. I mean, I really do. I feel it. And some people are 5 years old when they know that everybody doesn't get everything. And then some of us go longer. But I mean, I feel like that's this very universal fall from innocence, is that you're not going to get everything.
I also think it's easy enough in theory. Okay, I can live in a city, but then I can't have a garden. Okay. But when it comes to something you like, a child you want with your whole heart, or I don't want my mother to die, or whatever, something where you're like, no, this is not a casual request.
Yeah, it's not a nice to have.
No.
It's a must have.
I must have this.
Yeah.
And I think this is a coming of age story, and my coming of age was realizing you can want something with your whole heart, from the deepest part of yourself, for the best reasons. It doesn't mean you're going to get it.
Yeah. But you get other things.
But you get other things, and you better be grateful for them, because the alternative is to have a grumpy life.
Yeah, and that's no kind of life.
I don't want that.
Not for us, baby. So we have a few minutes set aside for questions, and we'd love to hear from you. But first, let's give Arielle a huge hand.
And Kelly.
Was the title always right? The Rules Don't Apply?
Yeah.
And that's always kind of the way you thought of it?
No, at one point I wanted to call it To the Blue Sky and Back.
Oh.
To the Blue Sky and Back, which I thought was pretty. And also The Blue Sky was the name of the hotel in Mongolia.
Did you ever think that maybe you weren't going to write that essay?
No.
You knew.
Well, the book was a choice and involved work and craft and decision-making. The essay, Thanksgiving in Mongolia, she's talking about, it came out in The New Yorker, was not a choice and was not a decision-making process. It just came out of my fingers.
And you won every award a magazine article can win for that, right?
Just the one.
That's the one. She won the one. Was there anything that your editor said during the process of going back and forth that said, this is too hard, you're showing too much, this is going to be too hard for people to absorb this?
My editor at The New Yorker, who's a man named Nick Troutman, who I love very much, I gave him the essay and I was like, is this okay to do? Like, what do you think of this? And he called me and he was crying.
Oh.
And I was like, okay, great.
Because you had not written a personal essay for The New Yorker yet at that time.
No way.
You had covered other people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
I imagine you still are in some ways, but when at sort of the hardest moments of bearing the unbearable, where did flickers of comfort come from, if that even applied? Was it from friends or inside yourself, or I don't know, where was that?
It was my friends, and it was, thank you, that's a really lovely question. And it was from my friends, and it was from my mom. And that's the thing. I think, you know, my mom feels really, really guilty that she had this lover coming in and out of our house when I was a kid. And she's like, how could I have done that? And the thing I keep trying to tell her, and I think she's starting to accept it, is like, all right, maybe you didn't win the Mom of the Year award when I was a little kid, but
much less Wife of the Year.
That, I think, there's, she's definitely not in the running for that. But no one would accuse her of being in the running for that. But to me as an adult, she's the best mother you could ever have. And in this experience, that chick was amazing. She was right there. She was amazing. She came right away and stayed with me and just kept saying all the right things. She just kept saying, you're not alone and you're going to be fine. She didn't say what many people said that I didn't really like, which was, you'll have another one. And I didn't like it for two reasons. One, I was like, I don't want another one. I want that one. That's my son. And also, I was like, you don't know. You don't know that I can have another one. And I can't. But you'll be fine, I liked. And I am fine.
How did John arrive to where he is when he first saw you? Was it also a slow process? Was it love at first sight? I imagine it wasn't love at first sight. But
it kind of was. I mean, we kind of both were like, I distinctly remember thinking, I will deal with you later.
Like, you're something. I got you.
Like, oh.
Oh, boy.
This is a thing now. But I can't deal with this. I will deal with you later. And then, of course, I subsequently was like, I will not deal with you later. Like, that was just crazy. You know, I'd lost a lot of blood. Like, I did not think that was reality. And I think for him similarly. I think similarly he was like, whoa. And then was like, well, I'll never see you again as long as I live.
Can you just indulge us with the first time you saw each other again after?
No, that's private.
It is. Will you tell me after we take the microphones off?
That's the next book.
Yeah. Thank you. So
thank you
to the JCC.
You guys are great.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was journalist and staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, Ariel Levy, whose new memoir is The Rules Do Not Apply. She was joined in conversation by writer Carrie Corrigan. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.